the Western Contours Podcast, sharing experiences, providing insight, and looking for solutions to become better hunters. Whether you're chasing bugles over the next ridge, sitting a stand out east, this is about passion, pursuing our dreams of field, our lifestyle, the betterment of self and community, the enlightenment that comes from those moments spent in God's creation. Through these conversations, I hope you find insight, inspiration, education, and motivation to push beyond your limits.
So I'm going to throw a loop for this one. I was thinking about, I got three studs here in terms of conservation, protecting our rights as hunters. We sit down and we talk about, you know, HAL for wildlife and the importance of, and Coloradans for responsible life, for wildlife management, save the hunt. But the one thing that no one, I shouldn't say no one, I'm making assumptions because I don't have time to listen to all the podcasts.
Neither do we.
So I want to talk about you guys, right? Because the energy, effort, time, dedication, finance, there's something in each and every one of you guys. This means enough to dedicate that much of your life to. I want to talk about you guys. I want to talk about why it's that important to you. And then we can get into how important HAL is and Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. But let's talk about you guys for a moment. I'd rather hear about you guys and understand the background and the drive behind everything.
It's all because we are all salaried. We all make $1 million a year each. So yeah. that's pretty good motivation.
We haven't gotten paid yet.
But. Yeah. Well, we don't. John and I have never paid ourselves anything in any way, shape, or form with HAL for Wildlife. I think as this grows, it's a full-time job. Sure, that will probably need to change at some point because it is a full-time job. And I have a full-time job. And so does John. We have multiple jobs, right?
I have a business.
Yeah.
Well, I had a business. I don't know if I do anymore, but I had one.
Your business is my business now, buddy.
Yeah,
or my business is your business. Yeah. It's everybody's business. That's the point.
Yeah.
I think with HAL, we started for a very specific reason and kind of just wanted to dip our toes, in a sense, into the water to see where this would go. And it has just turned into, wow, this is really working and people are hungry for what it is that HAL accomplishes, which is basically bringing everybody together. I see it as millions and millions of sportsmen and women. And let's see what happens if we bring everybody together and form something for real and see what happens with funding and with the unity of voices. Let's see where that goes. And so what your question was, like, what motivates us? Because I think there's a real chance to do that. And it's, I think when I say we, I'm talking about you and everybody else here.
Sportsmen.
We as sportsmen have a chance to make history and to change what some may feel that the way the tide is going. I think we can change that. We have the numbers and, you know, the funding if we funnel it correctly. I don't know what motivates. It's a hard question to answer.
I'm going to give you my selfish answer. The selfish part of me is along the lines of what Charles just said, but it's from the standpoint of wanting to leave my mark as a human being. I see something that I love, which is hunting in the outdoors. I have the desire for that to continue on so that my kids can enjoy it, my grandkids can enjoy it. So I always think about, like, what are people going to talk about me when I'm gone? And so if selfishly, I'm like, this is something that I'm passionate about and I can get behind and I can, it's worth the sleepless nights. It's worth the time and the effort, even though there is no paycheck. Therefore, I mean, I'm hoping there will be at one point that we get to that point that we will be able to at least compensate ourselves for our time or whatever. But the drive is really to leave my mark for me. I'm not speaking for these two guys. And with that little bit of selfishness, I see all the good that could come out of it.
Did you ever think? Because that's what we say. I think the first time you and I talk, we talk about the future of hunting. Did you ever think that you would have to defend it or fight for it for your opportunity the way that we've seen in the last 3 years?
Never in a million years.
I didn't 10 years ago. I didn't 6 years ago. I guess it started becoming clear when I started paying attention to the anti-hunting movement. It started becoming clear, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago to me personally.
Right.
I think it's a calling. I mean, we want to win, right?
Right.
I'm sick and tired, and we all are. We're sick and tired of the lies. We're sick and tired of just the outright misinformation about what it is that we do. And then when you look at, say, the last 100 plus years of when sportsmen came together to bring back populations and to manage and all, like, all that's just being crapped on and lied about.
Right.
And there's, we have so many facts and so many messages that we have to get out to the public. And it's like, well, somebody's got to do it. So we're going to do it. You know, like, why not? It has to be done.
What are the, why the lies? This is the part that does it. I can't make sense of it, right? Because if you look at it and these people say, oh, we love, you know, I love this animal, or I love that animal, we want more animals on the landscape. Why the BS when the management, when the model that we've been working under has worked? Why the outright lies when it comes to what we do and how that management takes place? It just, it doesn't make sense to me. It's strange almost.
I think if I was to guess, if I'm assuming, if you were to ask that question, if you were to ask me why the lies come from the organizations, because I think that's how they fundraise off the lies,
which they're taking money into their personal coffers. Mm-hmm. Where on our side, no one's taking money into their, you know what I mean,
to extraordinary amounts,
right?
I mean, you know, they're chock full of lawyers. They're getting paid millions and millions and millions of dollars. It becomes a fundraising thing for them. For, I think, a portion of their followers, it's a mixture of emotions and misinformation in the way that hunters have been painted.
And I think a lot of it is that we've misinformed our side just as much as the opposition. And I say the opposition, the anti-hunting extremists, have informed their side. They mislead their followers who are uneducated. And some of our groups have misled our followers as uneducated too. I mean, you know, you look at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, you look at Congressional Sportsman Foundation, Sportsman's Alliance. We all are members, or we join all of that stuff, but do they do what we think that they do?
Right.
Are they doing what their mission says to do? Now, I'm not saying they're intentionally lying to us, but they're not doing the yeoman's work to talk to that group that the other people are being that are lying to them. There's a group in the middle there. Every member of the HSUS or Wild Earth Guardians, Defenders of Wildlife, is not an anti-hunter, but they've been misguided or lied to. And everybody who's in that middle is not an anti-hunter, but our guys have convinced them that they're some antichrist. You know, they're the Satan on the other side. That's not the case. I said this on that Bobby Marshall podcast Wednesday. The opposition is just as passionate about wildlife as what we are.
I think they're more passionate. I think we're passionate about the ideas, right? The dreams of that big buck and that big bull. I think their passion and their drive is far greater than ours.
Well, I think their passion is greater in the sense to where they think that we are the bad guys. And they've been brainwashed to that point. If they really understood and would listen to what conservation is and where it came from and where it is and where it needs to go and who pays for it and how it's funded overall, you start to see people come across the aisle and go, well, I didn't know that. I had no idea that. Right. I mean, and I use an example of April 18th at Sportsman Day at the Capitol here in Colorado. We will have people, legislators and aides and interns that work at the Capitol that will come eat wild game. At our caucus, we feed 700 people. There's an animal welfare caucus, the Colorado Voters for Animals, going on inside at the same time. And the caucus leaders, the legislators, will come eat our stuff to go back in there and talk to them.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
Yeah. They'll grab our hot dogs, the wild game dogs, and go eat it in there with the vegetarians and the vegans.
That's funny.
I mean, but I think that we have not done a very good job of commingling our efforts and coalescing our processes and procedures of education. And when you talk about passion, we all have our passions of what we have in our lives. I don't care whether you're a UFC fighter or whether you're a, you know, fighter jet pilot or you're, you know, an oil rig worker. We all know what we want to do. The problem is when you get into avocations, like recreational type stuff, we have professed that this is a sport, which then turns around and turns people off. Mm-hmm. It's not a sport. An avocation is something that you strive for personal endeavors and gratitude of what you're trying to accomplish inside your own well-being. If you want to consider it a sport, fine. Maybe animal activism is a sport for all I know. I mean, but I guarantee, look at this group that's around here. We said this when we were in Salt Lake. We said it when we were in Reno, mm-hmm. in Vegas. I don't know, but I don't think they have animal rights extremist conventions.
Right.
If they do, I don't think they have shows that they go to and they all come together and they have podcasts.
And they're certainly not doing raffles and auctions. They're not racks. Where you're going to win the best bird watching trip ever. No. You know, you're not.
No, they did.
You're not doing those things.
Individual organizations might do something, but they don't do something of this magnitude. Every single person that comes in here that buys a license contributes to conservation. If they did all go to an animal rights convention or extremist convention, how many of them kick in money to the cause? They kick in money to the organization cause, but not to the overall cause about conservation and wildlife management.
Where does the consumerism portion of our demographic, in my opinion, and this is solely my opinion, is where I see the biggest hurt previously? How do you think that consumerism portion of it really drug us into that sports realm or that realm to where it's about the next latest greatest, where we're ignoring, I shouldn't say ignoring, but.
It's actually kind of ties into, I wanted to say something before, so I'm going to preempt this with this.
Say it.
So we're very passionate about doing what we do. Okay. Our main goal is to get whatever animal species it is that we're interested in on the ground to enjoy the hunt, whatever. It's all about the hunt. And the anti-hunters, their hunt is stopping us from doing what we do. Okay. So that I wanted to say that out loud. So that's why it seems like maybe they're more passionate than we are. It's just conservation and advocacy and all that stuff is secondary to us. Okay. Going back to what you were just saying. So if you take what I just said and you look at how much time and effort we're spending on wanting to succeed in our goal into hunting, it boils down to finding the silver bullet. What's the gadget that's going to help me? What's gear is going to make me be a better hunter? What newest, latest, greatest bow or rifle is going to help me be more successful? And it's just the industry fed off of that whole idea. So we kept talking to our echo chamber within the industry and coming up with marketing ways. That's why, like, kill shots and all these things that were unfavorable or unsavory to somebody who's not a hunter, these are all the things that sold things within hunting really well. Like, I mean, for a while there, you couldn't see a broadhead commercial on, I mean, it was on hunting TV that didn't show like the most blood,
right?
So with us trying to be better at speaking within the, or not speaking, but selling within our echo chamber, we started doing things that made us look worse in front of the anti-hunting and non-hunting public. Right.
Well, part of it too is human nature is bigger, better, meaner, faster, stronger. At least most of it is. If we don't do things bigger, better, meaner, faster, stronger, then where do we challenge ourselves? I don't care if it's higher education. I don't care if it's a bigger house, a better truck, a trophy wife. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, we always want the best that we can get. Somebody wants to take the best away from us, no matter what it is. The pursuit is a major part of what you're talking about, the hunt in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But this industry has been created for bigger, better, meaner, faster, stronger. Every single aspect.
Sure.
I don't care if it's the clothes. I don't care if it's the boots. I don't care if it's the fly fishing. I don't care if it's the archery. It's make it better. That's human nature. Now, you get into fair chase, that's a completely different discussion. But it wouldn't matter whether we had the most rocket science tool out there or the most atlatl Neanderthal tool out there. The antis don't want us to use any of it, period. It's zero. And so how do we bridge the gap between the top and the bottom to get them to understand it's not about the low part, it's not about the high part, it's not about even the overall harvest? And I'd say that tongue in cheek, because 91% of all elk hunters in the state of Colorado are unsuccessful, but 100% of them are paying in so we can turn around and have the opportunity to be unsuccessful.
Amen.
Sean Ender on our videos that he did. You imagine going to a grocery store 91% of the time and being unsuccessful? People wouldn't like that very often. But we still pay for the opportunity to do it, and we pay for the opportunity to even apply for the license to be able to do it. But this industry here helps fuel and fund that component of conservation and wildlife management. And I think that we're creating a movement in conversation, and maybe it's just in theory, that this industry is starting to recognize what the efforts that we are doing collectively and individually. And if we can defeat measures like what we're dealing with here in Colorado this year and other states, maybe you start to get some buy-in from the industry. And maybe it's not all at once, but for crying out loud, we're not getting all the buy-in from all of us all at once either. So I think there's an opportunity to capitalize. We've got D-Day coming on November 5th if they get enough signatures to go to the ballot. But in the meantime, we need to educate our crew. We need to make sure that our team, our resource that we've got here, is on board with what we're trying to accomplish. Because if we can't do it here, we damn sure aren't going to do it to the middle of the roaders.
Right.
That's 75 or 80% out there.
100%.
There.
Guy, what you were saying, I think, is when you're saying consumerism, trying to just think through this. So if I'm not a hunter, or if I'm an anti-hunter, and I want to look up hunting, let's say if I'm not a hunter, leave out the anti-hunters. If I'm not a hunter, I don't know anything about it, I look up hunting.
You see me.
Or, yeah, you might see me. Or if I'm reached by the anti-hunters, what image am I going to see? I'm going to see the images that John was talking about, the worst case scenario, right? And what we don't do, well, what we haven't always done, it has changed, but what we haven't always done is do a good job at really sharing the story of what really hunting is, or beyond that, what conservation is, where the dollars go, the food aspect of it. Very simple things that I think we take for granted. Well, doesn't everybody know that we eat wild game?
No, they certainly do not.
And in fact, the anti-hunters can run entire campaigns saying they don't eat it, which is just a lie, but they get away with it because
we're not
out there combating that.
Right.
We're not out there saying, nope, here's laws. You do have to eat it. And not just because we have to, because there is a law, we want to, you know, it's like a part of why a lot of us do this.
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is if I was to go to an anti-hunting website, I'm probably not going to see on their website a meat eater episode,
right,
where it shows A to Z and it ends with cooking and all that.
They're showing what we're showing.
They're gonna find the worst case image and say, this is why you need to be passionate about saving wildlife.
Isn't that?
So then they're like, yeah, let's save wildlife. But the thing about it is, we are saving wildlife, but we do not market that.
Right.
We don't tell the people that.
They're using what we're posting or editing out everything that should matter for that 10-second finale. And that's what they're using. But that's, you know, and maybe I use the wrong word with the consumerism, but I think that is where it comes from in my head, right? I mean, and nothing, you know, companies are built to make money, right? And they got to market, and marketing works, and that's the way we do it. So I'm not bashing the companies, but I see it as a detriment when it's used against us. And I can't say it drives me crazy, because I love seeing that vapor trail fly 300-400 yards, right? Yep. There ain't nothing better than watching that.
Most people do. You're not any different than anybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you, like, anecdotally, if as an outfitter, if I put up a reel to sell hunts that show kill shots, you know, I famously did one that was just for javelina hunting. You know, it showed like 7 kill shots for javelina. I mean, I sold so many hunts because of that stupid reel, because that's what our world wants to see.
Right.
Okay. Now take that out of the context of hunting and people who understand hunting and what that means. And so a guy looking in there that's a hunter, sees that and is like, oh, cool, I can have success with this guy. That spells success to me. But somebody from the outside looking in and is like, oh, that's horrible. They're just blasting,
blasting and letting
this
him
guy
play.
Just killed seven javelina in 30 seconds,
right?
You know, whatever the case may be.
And they can label that however they want,
right?
You know, it becomes like we're just feeding them their, you know, the content that they need. Yeah.
Right.
And we aren't on the other side of that putting a lot of dollars into marketing and framing the messaging that works with the general public. That's one thing we absolutely 100% have
well,
to do.
And what works with the general public is how does wildlife and hunting and fishing benefit them?
Yeah.
Because they really don't give a crap about us until they figure out that maybe us is one of their relatives, or maybe one of us is their kid's soccer coach. And then they start to put two and two together. I was just talking to some kids over in the booth earlier and talking about ambassadors. Every sportsman, I'm not just saying, you know, hook and bullet, redneck, you know, killer, that the ones that just go out and smoke stuff. I'm saying sportsmen, sports people, whatever you want to call them. We have the ability to be ambassadors. I mean, if you wear your Broncos shirt, your jersey, or your Rockies one, you are an ambassador for a team. Right. Why the hell can't we even be an ambassador for our team of 14 million hook and bullet people?
Well, I think further than that, we need to realize that we are, whether we realize it or not. And I think that's part of the problem is people don't realize that ambassadorship as they're moving through this landscape.
You know how many guys, and I live in Colorado, and you know how many guys I see come through Canyon City where we live, and I'm, you know, working in Pueblo and stuff during hunting seasons. And the way out-of-staters and in-staters alike, but mostly out-of-staters, the way they display their catch when they're kill, when they're moving through the state. Well, they're going to Ohio for crying out loud with this thing strapped on top of their four-wheeler on the back of the truck. Now, antlers are one thing, but why do you got to put the head up there? Well, you got to travel 1,500 miles in the sun going all the way, and it's wherever you go. And I'd be thinking, how many people did you see that saw you that thought, well, that's an animal killing son of a bitch.
Right.
Right. But that goes back to, and the only way that I could, it's like that kill shot, right? It's pride in the crescendo, but with no explanation, it's like, woohoo.
Right.
But again, like John said, that is what, in this circle, we could appreciate everything that more than likely went into that, right? There's some instances where a guy got luckier than, you know, all get up, walks out, and boom, there it is. But you know, it's crazy. And I want to display it. I want to, you know what I mean? But I don't know that it's appropriate anymore. It's so hard to do.
It's such a tough thing because you never know, especially when you're talking about social media, you don't know who the end user is. You don't know who your audience is. Like you might start talking to your group of people, but within your group of people, you know, all right, so the way like, the algorithms work in most social media is you like my posts, but you have a friend, you have two friends that are not necessarily anti-hunting, but they don't hunt. They're non-hunters. Well, now they saw the post because you liked it and maybe one of them commented on it. Now it opened it up to all their friends who's, you know, could possibly be anti-hunting, could possibly be, you know, on the fence one way or the other. So you never know who you're talking to. And I said, it's a tough thing because if you're in the industry of hunting and you want to sell something, you're like, okay, I need to present it this way so that it'll sell. But I also want to protect hunting, so I don't want to show this. Like you're it's,
right.
I'm constantly battled with this. Like I'm an outfitter. I have a hunting podcast. You know, all these things that I know, if I market it this way, I'm going to get better traction. But I also know if I market it this way, I'm going to get negative.
Okay, so where's the line in the sand?
I don't know.
So to speak, well, when it comes to telling that story and whether or not someone that's in the middle or, you know, anti or is going to sit through the story and not just the trace.
Well, here, and we got spoiled with this digital social media era in the day when they didn't have any of this. And I can say this because I'm older than the rest of you, probably you. I thank you. Not any smarter than the rest of you, but I'm older. used to have ads in magazines, used to have brochures, used to have flyers. Nobody used to be able to turn around and pop up something and be able to take offense to it immediately just because they saw or somebody posted on YouTube or Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or whatever the hell else is out there. You can find the good and the bad immediately now and then synthesize that and spread it worldwide in milliseconds. Before, if you did anything, there was a common component of you had to put it out there. Somebody had to view it. Somebody had to share it. But they shared it by mail. Or they took a picture of it, and then they shared it or whatever.
Well, you had to pay for it if you wanted to see it, too, right?
You know, and now you don't have to do any of that. And I think that, you know, the grip and grin type stuff that you see is off-putting to a significant amount of people. And I know this from a fact of what we've been able to do on different studies to qualify and quantify people's perceptions, human dimensions. And I can tell you that, and I won't cite what it is because of where it came from, but you show a picture of a deer and you've all seen them. The camera view is of the deer laying there and somebody's walking up to the deer. You know, it's just a still image, static shot. That resonates with about 85% of the general public. You show a grip and grin pose, it resonates with less than 12%. Wow. Same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just that now I did this. Well, they know you did it before because you were walking up to it. When you turn around and show that same image without a gun or a bow in the picture, it goes up to 35%. Those are numbers that people better take damn close attention to, because when you grab it like this and you got your gun there, I'm the victor. I'm the Viking. I'm the king of the world. When you turn around and walking up to it, or you don't have the tool of choice in hand, the general public looks at it as a completely different deal than if you put the gun or the weapon in it.
Wow.
Those are things that we don't pay attention to. I mean, I guarantee that 99% of the outfitters that are in here, and most of us combined, put our weapon in there. We want to show what we use, the tool, the method of choice. Got the suppressor, the big scope on it. You know, you got the bullets on the side of the stock or your bow. Whatever sort of arrows you got, you're holding the arrow up. It's got blood on it. That is off-putting to 90% of the people at some point in time that are going to vote on all the stuff so we could continually do what we do or don't do. Those are things that I don't expect everybody to learn, but we have to have a cognizant ability to say, and this is my idea. In China, it's a little different because I've been there. But Thanksgiving, we all eat turkey, or maybe some of us eat ham or whatever we eat on Thanksgiving, but we eat turkey. But what would the image be? Thanksgiving dinner, you turn around and brought the turkey on the table, cut his head off and gutted him and turned around and did him right there on the table in front of everybody. It's just still the same thing. They're eating. Mm-hmm. It's just of how was it presented. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a big difference of what we can do in our society when we're doing hunter education for kids. Yes, we want you to be proud of what you do, but you don't have to turn around and be so bastardizing of the issue of what we're doing. You are not the great white hunter. You accomplished something because human nature has allowed us to be able to do that historically throughout time. You know, I joked the other day that I could only see the knuckle dragon Neanderthals, and they were probably me going out there. And Charles, as smart as he is, he would have been the guy doing the petroglyphs in the wall. He'd have been doing the pictures of me out in the field.
Keep going. That's a good point. Keep going.
because
keep going on how smart I am.
Yeah. Yes. I'm like,
it's, yeah. Notice it's, how you didn't choose me to be the smart guy.
Yeah. I was going to ask where John fall into it.
Well, he would have been the guy that tells
Charles.
The
guy eating rocks.
Yeah, he was the guy telling Charles that doesn't look like a sheep.
On what Dan was saying, it's understanding that we aren't the majority. We're not in control here. We are the minority. So as much as I hate to say, because there's nothing wrong with posting a grip and grin. There's nothing wrong with that. I get it. I get what it is. That's the pinnacle of that adventure.
Well,
to some extent, right?
That's the pinnacle of the touchdown. Yeah,
you know?
But it's the pinnacle of some guys. 3 years is that one animal
or longer.
But you got to tell that story.
But
because if you don't, somebody else is going to tell it for you.
You got to tell the story. But what's the tough part, we have so much work to do. Back to the petroglyphs. So why did they paint or carve or draw petroglyphs?
Tell the story.
And it's the air race and the deer.
The tracks.
They're proud of it.
Right.
They're proud of the success that they had. So that us being proud of it, is not a new thing.
Right. No.
We've been in a way posting grip and grins forever.
Stonogram.
Yeah. Like, look what I did, and I have the claws or whatever. Right. You know? Yeah, Stonogram. Like, that was their Instagram,
right?
Was the cave. So it's like, all right, well, I mean, how do we balance that? How do we tell the problem is most of humanity today, we go to grocery stores, or we're not involved in the process at all. And us as hunters are somewhat involved in the process to some extent. You know, we still have cars and airplanes and, you know, not quite the same as a thousand years ago or whatever, but we're still a little more involved in the process. We literally put our hands in the animal and take the meat and put it on our backs or on horses or four wheelers, whatever, and bring it home and cut that up and then put it in your wrap it, put it in your freezer and serve it to ourselves or to friends and family. Like, that's the beautiful process. And we're all super, super proud of that. So how do we balance that? I mean, man,
how do we tell that part of the story? So,
right. It's about education. It comes down to, eventually, if we can reach enough people in the middle ground, the people that non-hunters, if we can teach them what the truths of hunting, what it means to us to hunt, what the process, because I mean, so many people don't even know that there's tags, there's licenses and hunter education. You know, there's a lot of people think that
game
we just
managers.
That we just go out. There's a lot of things that we take for granted as hunters. And, you know, we talked about being ambassadors. And I remember this vividly, especially from about 2010 to about 2017. Everybody wanted to be a pro staff. Guess what? Everybody listening to this, I'm going to make you a pro staff right now. You're a pro staff of hunting, okay? It's part of what you were saying, the consumerism and stuff like that. That whole pro staff movement is why you see more people putting their bows in the picture. Why? Because it helped companies sell things and you got free things to do it. You know?
We just got flashed by Man Boo.
totally threw me off.
I saw him like open up a little bit, and I was like, "What the hell is this?"
He was concentrating on Charles. I just want to make sure.
That was his trophy pick right there,
man.
That was awesome.
That was interesting.
You know, but to capitalize on, so we talk about storytelling. We all watched stuff on Sunday mornings. You know, the Pursuit Channel and Outdoor Channel, we've seen stuff, you know, 365 days out of the year, it's on some channel. But one of the most inspiring individuals, I think, is storytelling, to where people that are on our side and that are also middle of the roaders that can actually enjoy what the story is when you watch Jason Matzinger's stuff. It's a storytelling. It's not just about the grip and grin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's about the conquest. It's about the preparation. It's about the endeavor. It's about the heartache. It's about the headache. It's about the financial components. It's about everything that goes into every single one of our lives when we turn around and do this. I would encourage people to go out and watch what Jason produces, because there's some guys out there that do similar things, mm-hmm. but more often than not, they're doing it for simply entertainment and the consumerism side, as opposed to the storytelling side. And being able to turn around and say, this is who we are and this is why we do it. And I say that not tongue in cheek, and I'm trying to give him a plug, but I've had people that are not so much, they're not anti, but they're not pro hunting. And you show them clips of mm-hmm. different things and they go, where do I find that on YouTube? Where can I see that? Because that's not the typical hunting show.
Right.
No, he spells a story out for conservation, and hunting is a component of that. People misinform other people that they say that hunting is conservation. Conservation is hunting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what we do. And, you know, I made this joke, I think, I don't know, one of the podcasts that I've done. My grandma used to preserve things. My grandpa used to say, no, you conserve things, because our intent is to eat it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to turn around and create preserve and put them on a shelf forever.
Right.
Well, we don't do that with wildlife, and we don't do that with natural resources. And we don't, it's, if we do, what the hell are we supposed to do on the rest of this planet? Look at Shane Mahoney's, the Wild Harvest Initiative. It talks about all the components of wild harvest on the planet. And if you look at those graphs and data and statistics, the story that comes out of that is that without wild harvest, we don't feed the planet. We cannot produce enough domestic food or livestock in any capacity to feed the entire planet. We get berries, we get medicinal plants, we do all the things off the landscape. And on every continent, in some capacity, we don't just eat from whole foods. And I think the story that can be told is about human consumption and human conservation, not preservation, because it goes in every single thing that everybody has to do. They have to eat. And I don't care where you come from on that side of the spectrum, whether you think it's veganism, vegetarianism, you know, keto, whatever that, I don't care what it is. We all have to eat. That's one thing we have in common. We breathe air, we eat, we got to drink water.
I don't know. We got a lot of different titles nowadays, man. We might have like a non-eater or something. Yeah. Somebody's going to try it. I mean, the shit's getting crazier and crazier. Yeah. So,
well, I want to see that guy. He ain't going to be around very long. So.
good for them.
Yeah. Whatever your title
but
is.
But the storytelling part of what we have, game agencies haven't done a very good job of it. Our NGO community hasn't done a very good job of it. They have to us. They happen to the general public.
Yeah.
The game agencies do a piss poor job when it comes to the general public. I mean, they're working for the general public, for all the people. If you read our mission for Colorado Parks and Wildlife here in the state, it talks about the visitors and the residents and visitors alike. Everybody combined. Doesn't matter whether you hunt, doesn't matter whether you don't hunt, doesn't matter whether you're anti-hunter. They're doing it for everything. And I think that our story is that we can turn around and pedestalize what we do, not marginalize it, not bastardize it. And we just don't do a very good job. We don't have to have all the guys that do it. But the people that are in front of people, the industry leaders, the NGOs, they better figure out a way to start doing stuff in the next 5 to 10 years, because you're going to have another bunch of young people coming up that are 12 to 14 years old now that are going to start voting in about 5 to 5 years. We have to capitalize on them to tell them the story about conservation that they engage in.
Yeah. You wanted to say something, but going back to what I was saying before is everybody wants to be a pro staff. Be a pro staff of hunting. Be an ambassador of hunting. Educate yourself on what's going on. That way you can have intelligent conversations and give this lacking information to the non-hunters, to the people in between. We all know people, we all interact with people who are not in hunting. You know, it's very easy for us to have a conversation with somebody at work or in the break room with the water cooler or whatever, or online waiting for coffee, and give them something positive to stew on. Otherwise they're just being, you know, exposed to it from anti-hunt.
So the pro staff thing is funny, right? Because Hal's giving pro staff free memberships. So there you go.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna rewind us. So John talked about his kind of, I hate to say it like that, his kind of why. That's Robbie's hick phrase there. But he talked about legacy, and Charles took us a different direction, and I don't think intentionally. So why the time and the effort and energy and everything into this for you, Dan?
Since I was a kid.
4 score 7 years ago.
Yeah, 4 score 7 years ago. Or the one of those deals like the old Outdoor Life. There I was.
He's going to, you know, by the way, he's going to make me self-conscious because he looked at me like, I think I'm older than you.
he started to wonder again, how old is he?
It was a low blow.
Hell.
I do have a lot of grays, but that's all right. Buddy. Well,
mine's getting to be more. My eyes are redder. I know that. When I was a kid, I grew up around taxidermists and hunting guides and outfitters and trappers and Western artists. I mean, some fabulous Western sculptors and painters than in this circle that I was in as a kid. I'm talking 12, 14 years old, game wardens, wildlife managers, biologists, landowners, old school, you know, tobacco chewing, old truck driving, jump out of the pickup and wrestle a steer down landowners, ranchers and ag guys. I wanted to emulate all of that together. And I couldn't, you know, I tried to be a rodeo cowboy. Well, that didn't work. And
did
tried
you?
To be a, yeah, yeah, I did rodeo.
I need to know more about that.
Yeah. not a rodeo clown.
I need to see some pictures.
yeah, not a rodeo clown. So, but I tried to be a rodeo cowboy and that didn't work out. Tried to be a hunting guide. Well, that's not full time. Tried to be a trapper, which I still am today, and run a wildlife control business, a human animal conflict business. To live it, breathe it, eat it, sleep it, drink it. I have seen more destruction in wildlife management and conservation from unknowing, uneducated individuals that I saw that was a wrong path. And not that I think that I can right the whole world, but one of the meetings that I went to in my early stages of my adult life, this was back in 1992 when we were on the bear deal, where they were trying to ban bear hunting in the state of Colorado.
All right, so he is older because that's when I graduated high school.
Yeah, well,
there you go.
I'm sitting in this meeting, and he's hounding us on bear hunting, hound hunting in the spring, baiting in the spring. How can you support death and destruction to millions of animals, like we were killing millions of bears?
I mean, yeah.
And I found out that he was a commercial builder. They used more habitat per year than what I ever turned around and took wildlife off the landscape. And I put it back on him and I said, you kill more than what I ever will in my entire life. And even in my wildlife conflict business, we harvest a lot of stuff. We kill a lot of stuff. We work on all that stuff, but we don't kill everything. But developers as a whole are not anti, but they don't think about what they do on the landscape and the habitat, the conservation side of it, because they're interested in progress. They're interested in self-preservation. They're interested in creating this component of human, bigger, better, meaner, faster, stronger, like what I started the conversation. I felt necessary to get engaged at different levels, and I didn't like the way other people were doing it, so I thought I'd do it myself. I didn't think they were doing it right. And obviously, they weren't, because they lost the bear hunting deal and the trapping deal in 96.
Right.
I started getting involved about 2005, 2006, hard, because most of the guys that are my age now started to age out or die out or move out of state, and there needed to be somebody to turn around and get engaged. So I took a bunch of different positions and thought that was the best way to go. Well, I've got a chip on my shoulder now, because it's not about your idea as an animal activist or extremist against my idea. It's a movement on that side to wipe every single one of us out of the equation of conservation in any way, shape, or form. And I think, you know, I said this at many different commission meetings, their number is zero. They don't want any animals harvested for any reason. They think it's okay to kill stuff in a conflict resolution deal. Oh, we don't want you to do this, but we'll allow this to happen just, you know, for...
And we'll pay somebody to
do it. And they'll pay somebody to do it. And so... Sure. Taking that into consideration of where we are today, I think that if we don't plant a flag in the sand, and I've observed this for 30 years, if we don't plant a flag in the sand, if we don't draw a line in the concrete and say enough is enough, I think that when I'm 70, 10 years from now, which you'll probably be 82 then, you know.
94.
Yeah. When I'm 70, I want to be able to turn around and say and look back and say, we planted our flag, we said enough was enough, and look at the progress we made in the last 10 years, as opposed to this doom and gloom, throw our hands up. Oh, we're going to lose another one, because it's happening in Kentucky. It's happening in Washington. It's happening in Oregon. It's happening in Texas and Pennsylvania and Colorado. You'd name me one state that doesn't have a legislative issue, a commission issue, or a ballot issue going up this year. Everybody has something going on. And if we don't plant a flag in the sand, I think that we're going to lose a lot more 10 years from now than what we lose already. And I saw that happen in the 90s and the early 2000s and the mid 2000s. And we're getting to a point now to where we have social media as our disposal, our tool. We have, I mean, how many conventions do you, of course, you weren't born, but 1970s, 1980s. You remember going to shows like this?
No, do I?
Yeah.
No.
No.
I did that. I was still in high school, 19 years.
Exactly. but if you look at what we created industry-wide, if we've created, you know, conservation-wide, look at most of our game agencies that changed their name from the 60s to the 70s, but most of the NGOs that came out in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
Why? Because they saw a need for conservation. What they didn't see is a need to fight for conservation. And I think that that's where we've been lacking, and to some degree, a large degree, for the last 20, 25 years. And I think it's damn time we turn around and turn it around. And we're starting something that is resonating very, very well on CRWM, Save the Hunt, with this issue that's going on in Colorado. And people are coming out of the woodwork around the country and out of Canada to say, you're speaking for me in Pennsylvania, for crying out, you know. You're speaking for me in Montana. Why? Because they have an interest in what happens in Colorado in conservation, wildlife resources, hunting and fishing. And I think it's a catalyst to where we can turn around and capitalize on it. So to say why I do it, is because I've watched it be pedestalized, bastardized, marginalized, eroded and degraded, then thrown up on top. I mean, 25 years ago, ask somebody about the North American model of wildlife conservation.
Scratching your head.
Yeah.
Not even that far ago.
No.
Call it 5-6 years ago.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about it, and they want to stop it. Why do they want to stop it? Because it works. Mm-hmm. Why do they want to stop hunting? Because it works. Because conservation works. And they don't have an alternative. They don't have a solution. They don't have a recommendation. They don't have a suggestion. It's you quit because I don't like you doing it. Period.
But what about so where does the discussion of the repercussions of that come into the conversation with these folks, right? Because if you're saying stop this, stop the model, stop this conservation effort, because that's what it is, what do they think is going to happen on the landscape?
Care. They don't care.
Doesn't make sense.
Because
they cared about all the animals.
Because they got lied to for the last 30 years about if you just stop doing it, it's going to go back to some sort of natural cycle of attrition, and Mother Nature's going to take care of everything. I listen to people every single time that I testify somewhere or that I'm in some public meeting. We need to have it just like it was. Well, then let's all get the hell out of Colorado and the West and let's all move somewhere else.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not talking about that. Well, that's what it would take to be like it was.
Right.
They've been told that if we stop, if we quit, that it'll go back to some natural nirvana, some sort of utopia, like what they envision Yellowstone. You know, I sat on the Wolf Stakeholder Advisory Group for 16 of 18 months to introduce wolves in the state as a management plan. The times that I heard people talk about Yellowstone, 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 come to find out half the sons of bitches I was talking to about Yellowstone had never been to freaking Yellowstone.
Right.
But they heard about Yellowstone and what the wolves did and how they turned around and created these beaver sanctuaries and for the elk and the moose and the willows all came back. And then the songbirds came back on top of the willows. But they'd never been there to see it. They heard the lies and the BS that came down. If they could convince them about Yellowstone, they can convince them about anything. And I think that when it happens in their backyard, they're easily swayed. But when you show them what they get out of the benefits of hunting and fishing, you as a non-hunter get the repercussions and the benefits of what hunting and fishing provide by the sale of licenses. Whether you just want to know that wildlife's there, or whether you want to go out and take pictures, or you want to turn around and protest the fact that you don't want it. You know that we've provided the opportunity for you to do that. Because if we weren't here doing it, there wouldn't be anything to protest about. Eventually, it would be done, and you'd be looking at more development, just like what I talked about 35 years ago when I was talking to those guys about the bear hunting.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It all comes down to the education and information. Everything he just said, it's all back to what Charles brought up before, what I said, what he had said earlier again. It's about reaching that middle ground and letting them know the truth and the reality. Otherwise, they're just exposed to the misinformation. They're going to... And now so more than ever, because the way we are in society, if we don't get information in 10 seconds, 3 seconds, whatever, and everything's in a very short form, they don't get the whole story. And the first person who reaches them is the information that they run with.
Right. Right. And so then attention.
You want to create a study? It doesn't have to be 10,000 people. Let's make a pact amongst ourselves and actually script this out. Let's say we interview 500 people in the next year, 500 hunters, 500 non-hunters, and 500 anti-hunters. Scientific. I don't know where the hell that comes from, but why do you hunt? One sentence. Mm-hmm. Why do you hunt?
Sure.
The middle of the road. Why do you think people hunt? Answer that question. The 500 anti-hunters. Why don't you want people to hunt? And then put those answers together and see where you come, because I guarantee there's a hell of a lot more commonality in there than what people believe.
Right.
Once you answer those questions, and it's not that hard to do it. Well, you could have 500 hunters right here and just answer the singular question. Why do you hunt?
I bet you we can have, what's his name?
Mark Duda. Yeah. Responsive management. Just simple, not data statistics and graphs and everything else. Three questions. Three different segments of people, you're going to find a hell of a lot more commonalities. And then if you can communicate back to those 500 of each one of those categories, you can compile a significant amount of data on how you message, from our perspective, how you message from the middle of the road. But I guarantee you're going to take a lot of information back to the other side, the anti-side, and say, look, you guys agree with us about 65% of the time. It's just that you keep saying no, 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 no. It wouldn't be rocket science to do it, and you could do it through these sports shows on the hunting side, and you could turn around and do it at baseball games or wherever the hell it's at. Maybe it's farmers markets or whatever. Do you hunt? Yes. Okay. Well, you're not in our subset here. Do you hunt? No. Why don't you hunt? Or why? What do you? Why don't you agree with hunting? Or why do you hate hunting? Why do you think people that? Whatever we come up with three questions, we could turn around and knock it out of the park for messaging, and that's education.
I love it.
Yeah, that's badass.
I hope when I'm 90, like Dan is,
that you're smart as me.
That I can be so smart and be so eloquent. No, that was your why. I think we can all relate to. I know that John and I can. We both grew up hunting since we were, you know, five or whatever, you know, as young as possible. I grew up in Michigan. I grew up with a hunting family. I thought everybody hunted at one point. So I didn't know people didn't hunt until I was maybe 11 or 12 or something or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, my why goes back to that as well. I mean, because I would get emotional. I feel like hunting has saved my life.
Same.
I don't know what I would do without it. Like, that's it's so a part of my DNA. It is what I think about. It is really all I eat, you know, unless I'm traveling or whatever. But I mean, my whole family, like we celebrate that, you know? And it's like, so for me to think about it being gone, it would be, I don't know what the hell I would do.
Yeah,
and I know that's the same thing that so many other people think and feel. And, you know, simple things, we can cause friction. So cats aren't trophies. They say people are not eating mountain lion. Well, we fired up the base and said, send us your mountain lion cuisine. And it has like never been done before. And the pictures we got are the most beautiful meals I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
I didn't even know it existed. Like mountain lion egg rolls. That's pretty cool. Who's this guy? You're learning about the stories of, you know, all these folks that are sending in stuff and how their kids eat it and whatnot. But we're throwing that out there and spending dollars so that messaging is landing in Denver or Seattle or whatever, and it's causing friction. Like, hey, who appreciates being lied to? Nobody. They're lying to you. Like, let's just throw this picture out there, and then somebody's going to look at it and go, well, hold on. Like, your campaign is saying they're not doing this. What are these pictures? What are these people doing then? Simple things like that we can do. And I think it's a start. I mean, I don't know where it's going to go. We're just kind of brand new here. We're trying whatever we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You almost have to do it that way.
We're just in the fight. I don't know. You know,
throwing punches everywhere.
Yeah. Doing what we can do.
And I mean, and honestly, and John and I were having a conversation before you guys got over here. And that was one of the things that we were talking about, was just the activation portion of it, right? That's been impressive to me. And I'm as cynical as they get about our involvement as sportsmen, right? I could be a downright a-hole when it comes to our, I think we talked about it in the last podcast, right? And I'll scream at us about what we don't do. And that's the one thing I've seen with Hal is that activation portion of it. I've seen more people involved now than I ever have, or, you know, asking questions and wanting to advocate. So I love it. Well, gents, we got folks sitting behind us in red shirts, I believe. So they got the booth, but I appreciate the heck out of all you guys and what you're doing and the continued efforts. And we'll keep pushing and
appreciate it.
See you guys hopefully at Western Hunt Fest.
Yep.
Have some booths out there and continue to spread the message to that piece of the demographic. So thank you all three very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. So, appreciate it.